Good evening. This is Thomas Steininger. Welcome to Redevolve, our global webcast for consciousness and culture. Today, our guest is Arnaud Lada. Arnaud, are you here in the Zoom room?
I am.
Yes, we can hear you. Arnaud, great that you're here. You usually live in Costa Rica, but right now we reach you in Athens, in Greece. So you are an activist who is also around the globe. If I just may introduce you a little bit for the part of the audience that does not know you. You are an executive director of The Rules, an organization that you also founded yourself, which is a global network of activists dedicated to changing the rules that create inequality and poverty around the world. You used to be also a member of the Greenpeace International USA, but now you're focusing on your work in The Rules. If I may start with a question, what is The Rules about?
Yeah, and first of all, thank you for having me and inviting me on to Evolve. The Rules is, we're a global network of activists, writers, researchers, voters, farmers, others, really focused on understanding the root causes. And by rules we mean everything from cultural norms, mores, practices, laws, etc., that create inequality, poverty, and climate change. So we come from a structuralist perspective, where we believe that all of these wicked problems, when we talk about things like climate change, these are not externalities of the economic system, as we're taught by neoclassical economists. Rather, these are the logical outcome of a set of rules that have been created, and so we have to understand the agency of that creation. Mm-hmm. Not as some, arbitrary thing that just happened to be, a little blip on our trajectory towards some kind of progress, which is the kind of Western rationalist Newtonian mindset, but really a deep set of problems that have come from, in some ways, really bad decision making, decisions that benefited a few and continue to benefit a few while impoverishing many and destroying the planet in its wake.
So when you say a set of rules, what kind of rules are you talking about?
Yeah, it's funny, right? Because people, when they understand our politics, they basically say, you believe in the decentralization of power, but yet you call this network, this organization, The Rules, and it's because we want to sort of change the rules and create new ones, but also undo rules that are created, and we don't just mean sort of policy or law. Or mm-hmm. the sort of traditional set of rules. It's really the architecture that keeps the modern machinery in place. So some of those rules are cultural. They're mores, they're norms, they're mm-hmm. incentive systems that perpetuates late stage capitalism.
You also say that you don't want just to externalize these rules, as you just said, they are cultural rules. They are rules that we create in the way we co-create our culture. Is it very much also our modern perspective, how we perceive the world, our modernist kind of understanding what this world is about, that creates these rules?
Definitely. Well, if you just look at almost in every way, how we, for example, understand reality. We've all, especially in the West, which is the dominant sort of cultural epicenter and political epicenter. The dominant belief system is one of a Cartesian, dualist, rationalistic worldview, where the prime metaphor, if you will, is human being as mechanism. Parts of the body, and even the way we think of the sort of the body politic or this the sort of our parliamentary system and all of these things. The representative democracy is one of those sort of manifestations of that metaphor, if you will. And so there's the very clear sort of link with sort of how power is distributed, you know, in the sort of machine-like way, but also our understanding of nature and our relationship to nature. You know, it's the direct descendant of the Enlightenment logic, you know, the famous Francis Bacon line, nature must be tortured for her secrets. Mm-hmm. The way we think of resources, natural resources, a sort of economic input. And all of these things are sort of centrally baked into the core logic of the operating system.
Mm-hmm. I do understand that this Cartesian worldview, where we see ourselves as separate individuals and where we understand the world as a kind of a mechanism, creates this alienation from nature and creates also how we treat nature. But it seems that you also think that the inequality of our world system also between us humans is related to this kind of understanding of us as humans. How would that look like? What's the connection between us seeing us as Cartesian individuals that are kind of on their own, isolated individuals, having kind of a rational relationship to the world and a rational understanding to the world? How does this translate to the inequality, the extreme inequality that we experience today in the world?
Yeah, and I would go even one step further and say the Cartesian dualism not only creates the inequality and the poverty, but also creates this deep spiritual ennui and sense of existential angst that we have, especially in the West. And the connection between all of these is, and you've touched on it, which is the base unit of being, right? In this Cartesian dominant Western culture, the individual is the prime unit of being, right? Mm-hmm. Everything is decided by this, you know, homo economicus, this rationalist being that is calculating their, you know, it's this utilitarian maximizer that is deciding on what is sort of best for himself or herself. And our entire structure and architecture reifies that in every way. And so we have these identities that are calcified by the jobs we do, and the first thing we're asked is, what do we do for a living? And we have these social media infrastructures that are all about sort of projecting a certain idea of who we are out into the world. And we have this self-help industry trying to help us find our identities and our purpose, so then we can say, you know, this is what we do. And think of everything from how we have our social security numbers and our licenses, and at every point we register our ID or our email address. The entire culture, the entire architecture, social cultural architecture, is geared towards making you reify yourself as the individual. And mm-hmm. if you step back from that and you look at spiritual traditions and mystical traditions, the purpose of the mystical tradition, and this is a broad statement, but is to sort of transcend the subject-object duality. It is to sort of reach the place of oneness that is beyond the individual identity. And I come from a Sufi tradition, the mystical branch of Islam. And one of the things that we talk about in Sufism is that the primary identity is the universal identity. And the secondary identity is this atomized individual body ego I have, which the external world describes as Al-Nur. And having that as the sort of base understanding that the universal identity, our oneness, is the primary identity, and the individual identity is the secondary identity. It's an anomaly by which one particular fractal in the system sees the world, would create a completely different type of social architecture and set of consequences. Now, if you take the Western materialist atomized version of that, and you say the primary identity that is reified at every single touch point is the individual identity, and this universal identity is maybe touched on very rarely in the more sort of peak transcendental experiences, like going to church on Sunday or something like that. Or when we see a starving child on television, or whenever our empathy is triggered in these, you know, rare moments where we actually orchestrate our lives so we never have to feel that, because it hurts the feelings, you know, it brings down the party for this individual atomized unit that's trying to, you know, maximize its pleasure. And so the fundamental worldview is really at the root of all of that. And if you feel separate, well, of course, then inequality is someone else's problem, right? You think of all the neoliberal ideology around poverty. Poor people are stupid and they're lazy. It could never be the structure. It could never be the system, because look how well I've done as a Westerner. So that identity is sort of the cause, if you will, in some ways. It's the root of a lot of these issues. And of course, then the leap to the spiritual ennui is very easy to make, because all of the social science research points to the fact that a lot of our depression and anxiety and angst comes from our separation from each other, being outside of community, outside of tribe, and our separation from nature, being at least conceptually, in our limited way, outside of our relationship with the Gaian entelechy.
I completely understand, but I would like to bring some arguments that usually people bring in who have very strong thinking about that our modern Western Enlightenment understanding of the world brought much more benefits than dark sides to what we're doing. And there are also a lot of social research out there that basically say that poverty gets less and less, and that we live in the most peaceful times of all times. I mean, there's just studies, and one can question part of the studies, but there's something also that has to be taken into consideration. Is it really that our Western understanding of us as individuals, our democratic freedom, our human rights, is something that is bringing us inequality and injustice? Isn't also something that we could call the dignity of modernity, where human rights, democratic rights, the understanding that we have all equal rights together, something that is also progress? Or would you dispute that?
Yeah, so this is really, it's such a good question, and your articulation of it is very powerful. Because this is exactly the type of belief that we need to expose, right? And there's really two questions. One question is, who believes this? Mm-hmm. Right? If you talk to the majority of the planet that is living under $10 a day, you know, which is probably 70% of the planet, they would not agree to that belief system, right? So it's who is asking this question. And the second belief, and it's really it goes to the people who do believe it, is you believe it could get better. So what actually happens is, by trying to celebrate the virtues of a system that has benefited a small group of people, usually in the West, most, or let's say disproportionately in the West, we end up apologizing for a system that does widespread destruction in its wake. And we should really go into the sort of these key premises, you know, and you've mentioned some of them. Poverty is reducing, even the idea of technology, I think, is a premise, a second premise worth talking about quickly. You know, the Bill Gates sort of worldview, which is, look, we have, every house has a microwave now and a television, and is this not progress? And then the third is about violence, you know, this reduction in violence, you know, and this has created some kind of modern dignity. So there's sort of three, let's just go through each one of these. So on the notion of has it gotten better? And the question is, well, what do we mean by better, and for whom, right? Mm-hmm. What we know is that if you believe, and this is really deeply ideological, right? If you believe that history is an arrow, and it's linear, and it's pointing towards progress, which is really the core tenet of the Western rationalist Enlightenment logic, then of course you're going to believe a lot of these things. But if we understand, let's say, Marshall Salen's work, who wrote The Original Affluent Society, that shows hunter-gatherers had highly egalitarian structures. We know this by bone sample and teeth samples, and you know, they were roughly eating 2,000 calories a day. It didn't matter if you were the chief of the tribe or a lowly gatherer. You know, we know history is not linear, that it's actually cyclical, that, you know, hunter-gatherers were working 10 hours a week. So in what way are our lives better? You know, so it's not as linear of a story as we actually believe it to be. So, you know, that's the first sort of thing to unpick. The second is we really have to look at history itself. So if we understand what has happened since the Neolithic Revolution, since we invented farming, for example, we've this high concentration of power in the hands of a few, right? So, you know, we were hunter-gatherers, and this is a simplistic way to just give this quick sort of historical take. But we were hunter-gatherers, really living in the bosom of the mother and in complete trust and symbiosis with nature, because that's what we relied on. And then we sort of invent Neolithic farming. And, you know, there's an argument to say that even within Neolithic times, we were quite peaceful till we, you know, this is the chalice and the blade argument, you know. And then there was these sort of violent barbarians that then invaded and took on farming. And in some ways, it doesn't matter. What happened as soon as we were sedentary, there was some mix that created a very calcified way of living that extracted from nature. And we know as soon as there was farming and a sedentary lifestyle, the first, we know this from cultural anthropology, some of the first buildings that were created were the granaries. Because as soon as you have surplus, you have to protect that surplus. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you protect the granary, you have militia. And as soon as you have militia, you have some kind of hierarchy. And then you get the modern city-state, like Babylon, with the ziggurats, with the high priests living at the top and those protecting the food living at the bottom. And this sort of hierarchy is the birth of modernity. The modernity is this sort of 5,000-year period. And if we look at history in that lens, we realize that every benefit we have in the social Western liberal democracies of Western Europe and North America and Australia and whatever other sort of enclave you think of as these great, you know, modern dignity sort of states embodied, have actually created their power and their wealth and their stability through slavery, through colonialism, through perpetual war, through rape, through pillage, through genocide. And so, of course, someone who's comfortable in Germany can now say, well, look how modernity has protected us. And it's like, well, actually, what has paved the roads of Western Europe is the blood of Congo and, you know, the rest of the colonies. And now in modern times, and this is not so like it's far away, you know, slave labor in China, working at Foxconn factories, and the exploitation of the poor by the rich. And mm-hmm. So I think that's really the first point is for whom and in what way did progress happen? Mm-hmm. The second point, and that was a long answer, and the other two won't be as long, but I'll just say quickly. The second point is, well, this idea that somehow poverty is going down. And actually, what we know is that poverty is not going down. It's just really how you calculate it. You know, it's almost been an accounting trick. And I sort of urge people to read Jason Hickel's work, who's a professor at the London School of Economics. He's an economic anthropologist. He just had a recent exchange with Branko Milosevic, who's the World Bank, former World Bank chief economist, and you really see this debate in their letter exchange. And I know he had another one with Martin Vermilion, who I think is the existing World Bank chief economist. And what you realize is, if you look at something like the Sustainable Development Goals, what they'll tell us is that by 2030 we can reduce poverty. we can eliminate extreme poverty. But they've just made up an arbitrary number, which is $1.25 a day. That's the measure that's used by the World Bank and the UN and the Gates Foundation and the IMF. So if you look at something like the Sustainable Development Goals, they require a 12 times increase in global GDP by 2030. That means the average GDP per capita on the planet would be about $100,000 just to remove people from living on $1.25. And that says nothing about $1.26 a day. You know, and the UN itself, a UN body, UNCTAD, has said that the minimum required for human dignity is $5 a day. And so actually what we're doing is telling a story of poverty reduction that is based on a bullshit arbitrary number that even the UN itself doesn't recognize. And the reason is they're committed to an ideological vision of the world, which is about economic growth at all costs. Now, the top 1%, for about every dollar of wealth created, 93 to 94 cents ends up in the hands of the top 1% of growth. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, if you're a one percenter, your only strategy for solving the world's problems is going to be more economic growth, more foreign direct investment, more GDP growth, and we'll couch it in many things, job creation, stability, whatever. But at the end of the day, they're benefiting 94 cents on every dollar. And so we have to ask the question of who's benefiting from the belief that poverty is decreasing. And it might make us feel good to perpetuate that meme, or it might even be something we believe because we look around Germany, or we look around Canada, the country I was socialized in, which is a very wealthy country, and we think that is true. But it's actually not true at a global level. Poverty is increasing. Inequality is the highest it's ever been in recorded history. You know, we have eight Western men who have the same wealth as the 3.5 billion human beings. And so we're living in peak poverty, peak inequality, peak hierarchy, peak patriarchy, and most importantly, peak destruction. So we can have the Bill Gates argument that we have a refrigerator or a TV or a microwave in every house, but we're also killing 200 species a day. You know, we're in the middle of the sixth mass extinction, and it's the Anthropocene extinction. It's a human-created extinction based on spewing carbon into the atmosphere because of excess consumption and greed and cannibalism and psychosis. So the question is, we may have a refrigerator in every house, but is it worth it? And what are we really measuring when we say that progress is increasing in this way? And what happens often is privilege is a blinding constraint. So we feel that this progress is happening, but we see that from the lens of privileged Westerners who are not really seeing the entire structural picture. They're not actually seeing what's happening to the world's majority, especially, you know, poorer people in countries in the global south. We're not seeing what's happening to the entire ecosystem, what's happening to species, to the ocean, to rainforests, to sort of topsoil and farming land. And in all of those, if you look at all those other important parameters besides who has a refrigerator in every house, we are on the brink of catastrophic destruction. And if we call that progress, we probably deserve the extinction we are heading towards.
At the same time, if I just take the picture that you're painting here, we are also living in a time where we as one humanity are coming close to each other in a way that we never have been before. And we are also, I would say, and I'm interested if you agree, that we are on the brink of a dramatic time change after 500 years of European American dominance in global history, mostly called colonialism. Things are changing right now, also with emerging powers like China, like India, and other people from other nations from the global south. This, together with a communication that all of a sudden we can talk to each other on a global scale, that I can talk to you as we do right now, that media streams not only come from the privileged northern countries to the south, but there are also media streams coming back. Something is changing where all of a sudden be also aware that situations are very different in different parts of this world. Is this something that allows us to respond in a different way to this global crisis?
Yes, totally. And you know, I think the reason it's so important to disarm the first argument comes back to this question of, can it get better? And if we have not actually seen the broader sort of structural picture, if we have not connected the dots and we've internalized what the dominant establishment culture wants us to believe, that poverty is reduced and somehow technology is going to solve our climate change problems and violence is reducing on the planet, then we can never get to the state of actually understanding what's happening. And you're right, what's happening at the same time is there's this beautiful interdependence that's being woven by webs of plant medicine and mycelial to the internet itself, to technology. All of these things are happening. So, you know, globalization with all of its shadow and all of its destruction and extraction and usurping of resources and exploitation of human labor and animals and all of those things also has a light side to it, which is this sort of deep interconnection of human beings as a result. And I would almost say in some ways the precondition is to understand what is happening to us. You know, it's the first step. And part of that, I guess in some ways, if you would say the second step, not that I believe in linearity, but these two things are sort of symbiotically connected, is this spiritual awakening that is happening. When we start deprogramming our mind in a political economic sense, when we realize that violence, for example, is not about how many deaths are happening or how many murders or homicides are happening or how many people are dying from war, but it's about this distributed fascism that's taking its toll on our psyche in every way. You know, advertising is a form of violence because it makes us feel inadequate and makes us buy shit we don't need in order to perpetuate an economic system that's destroying all of life. And that itself is war. That itself is a violence that can never be calculated in a traditional sense. And the enemies that we're facing are not going to look like Hitler or even Trump or Putin or Modi or Netanyahu. They look like thought forms. You know, they look like these Neoplatonic ideas, these memes, you know, invisible hand, the idea that selfishness will save us, the idea of technology, that somehow technology will save us. And so when we start deprogramming ourselves from these old mimetic ideals, and we avail ourselves to this opportunity that exists, but not in a naive sense that somehow our interconnectedness and the internet and all of these things are going to save us. But this requires deep spiritual work. It requires deep political work. And when we start connecting into that space and we sort of reclaim our seat at the table of co-creators, when we come back to the Godhead, then we can start creating the political, social, psychological, spiritual, and cultural change that's required in these post-capitalist worlds, in the realities.
I find it very interesting, and if I may kind of ask you a little more in this direction, because what you are describing right now as a, let's call it a renaissance of spirituality, is also a particular form of spirituality that is very much related to this planet, to the people around the globe, and to life as such. There are forms of spirituality that that came about in the Axial Ages, like in Europe, medieval Christianity, like Buddhism in Central Asia. All these kind of spiritualities seem to be mixed right now with a spirituality where we are very much aware that part of our spiritual awareness also has to include the aliveness of life itself, which is something that is more a spirituality that you would call an indigenous spirituality. And I think that part of what the internet also creates is that we are creating living networks of relationship, because part of the globalization, as you were describing, is the globalization of capitalism, is also the globalization of systems, of mm-hmm. economic systems, of systems of bureaucratic rule. But there's a different form of global relationship right now possible, where we connect from soul to soul, from face to face, talking to each other, finding each other, where something like direct human connection creates something that we are deeply aware that we really are not just figures or something happening on the other side. We are people who are sharing the same soul, the same love, the same life. And also because of the ecological crisis, that we are deeply aware that if we don't recognize that Mother Earth is a living wholeness in itself, we won't be able to overcome our ecological crisis. Is this part of the answer that we have to create together to really dive into a spirituality of life, so to say?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think what is happening is a new kind of gnosis, if you will. Mm-hmm. And if you look at all the key spiritual traditions, the ones that came out of the Axial Age, for example, they all have had a mystical impulse at their root. For example, you know, Sufism predates Islam. You know, it was the indigenous desert wisdom of its time that mm-hmm. Muhammad then integrated into Islamic thought, and has always been this sort of central pillar of mystical thought. And of course, Christianity had Gnosticism and various versions of it. Judaism had Kabbalah. There's many forms of deep esoteric mystical Buddhism. And of course, all the many indigenous traditions are sort of directly directly mystical. You know, they don't even need the sort of sub-distinction within themselves, because they are it. And what's happening is that, not to say that any of these paths are necessarily the right path, because what gnosis itself means is just direct experience, you know, disintermediated relationship with the divine. And that is what is happening through, you know, even the use of shamanic master plants like ayahuasca or San Pedro or psilocybin, or you know, even the sort of medicines of the technosphere like MDMA and LSD on the one side, or even just the rapid growth of various meditation techniques, or sort of yoga itself, or the sort of re-indigenization of culture that is happening through bringing back some of the original wisdom of First Nations. What's happening with all of these is that we are now creating our own syncretic relationship with the divine that is not mediated by some desert mythology or some old way our parents told us to practice. And not to say that there's not use and value in these traditional practices, but what we're starting to understand is that we ourselves are co-creators of a synthesis of tradition and a synthesis of lineages that actually live within our DNA. And if these old traditions, these previous traditions that had the answer, we would already be there. We wouldn't be in the situation we are in. And, you know, I sort of call this impulse like a mystical anarchistic impulse, mm-hmm. you know, because it is about disintermediation from power, from old stories and old mythologies. And it is also about embedding that practice within our own bodies, within our own communities, in our own relationships. And it's really a rethinking of everything. It's a rethinking of the political economy, because we understand that none of us are free until all of us are free.
But
eros, relationships, community, all of it.
Yeah. But is what you're saying not even much more fundamental and much more simple, that what is happening in all the ways that you are describing and the rediscovering of the divine sphere, that we as modern humans are rediscovering the sacred, and that part of what really created our modern world system is that we excluded the sacred from our way to relating to the world. In fact, in modern philosophy, in the modern worldview, a pragmatic utilitarian understanding of reality is basically what we are living from. We maybe go to church on Sunday, but the real relationship that we have is a very pragmatic, a very materialist understanding of what the world is about. And what seems to be happening right now in all this way that you're describing, also in the center of Western culture, being Western West European countries, being the US, being in Canada, that there is a reemergence of spiritual practice and a reemergence of, wait a moment, what's happening here, meaning our life, our being together on this planet, has a divine reality, has something sacred. Just the simple fact to come together in recognition that there's something that we can call sacred changes dramatically our understanding of what it means to be together. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, I would agree. And I think, yes, there's a rediscovering of the sacred, but also a rediscovering that the sacred is not outside of us. Uh-huh. We ourselves are sacred because everything is sacred. And I would, this is, in the simplest sense, you know, you would call this animism, you know, or neo-animism, you know, the idea that everything is alive and everything is interconnected and mm-hmm. in a one, including us. So, and this is really the mystical impulse of all of these traditions. This is what mysticism was, is to say that God or Allah is not above you or below you. It is flowing through everything. And we are co-creators of our reality, intertwined, sort of God becoming self-aware, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that is the sacredness of life.
Yeah. Because if we understand it this way, also what you were describing before, which I can subsume under the term of fighting for social justice and for ecological turnaround in the world, looks very different if you really look at from the perspective that you're describing right now. Everything is life, everything has a divine nature, and we're all part in this, we are all intertwined in this. Looking from this perspective, our engagement also for social justice, for fighting against equality and fighting also for a different economic system comes from a very different way to understand this, and also very different ways how we can go about this. Because if this is all embedded in this divine reality that you are talking, also the way how we find answers have to be different. First, would you see that way? And what are the different answers that emerge from this perspective?
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And it reminds me a lot of the sort of slogan, if you will, from Standing Rock was defend the sacred. And in many ways, that is the slogan for however you want to see it, the post-capitalist world, the post-modernity, meta-modernity, defend the sacred, because the sacred is everything, including us. And even we need to defend ourselves from the onslaught of modern, Western, linear, rationalist, dualistic thinking. And so, you know, for me, that is the key insight, is the political is the spiritual. Defending the sacred is defending my home, but it is also defending the sort of environment of the mind, the mind space, you know. So it requires spiritual practice, and it requires the political practice. And I, this question of answers, you know, and I, Thomas, you and I have talked about this during One World Bearing Witness and at other times, actually here in Athens, the last time we were there, we were here together in July when we met, this idea that, well, what is the role of not knowing? Mm-hmm. And we've discussed this in different ways, but the what we want to reach to is somehow to have an answer, right? Mm-hmm. And like if we believe, for example, that the universe is all knowing and infinite, and well, then it would know everything. But you know, but we don't necessarily. I definitely don't believe in predestiny, because that would mean every thought we were about to have was somehow pre-thought of. And so that can't be true. And yet the universe, perhaps the way to think about it is that what the universe has done is set a set of conditions for life to emerge. And it has a preference. And we can look at the universe's preference and say, well, there's a preference towards the increase in conscious evolution, in novelty, in complexity, in love, in healing, in beauty. And we see this sort of mimic. And so in some ways, the universe has preference, but it's in the not knowing. It lives in the place of not knowing, in the place of emergence, as 7 billion humans and the all the plant and animal life and the stars and the moon and all of the solar system sort of dance in this congress of life. And it's the same for us. When we go into the space of not knowing, we are actually mimicking divinity. And so we should have values and we should have a point of view on what's happening. We can't say we don't know what's happening with climate change, or we don't know what's happening with inequality, or we believe the power elites that poverty is decreasing. No, it's let's educate ourselves and deprogram our minds from the Western mimetic diseases and viruses. But at the same time, let's have a deep spiritual practice, which includes being in the not knowing.
Okay, let's clarify this, because basically you are saying two things at the same time, which at least on the surface look very contradictory. One, you are saying we have to educate ourselves. I mean, you call your organization the rules, and one of your basic demands is we have to understand and know the rules, how this system works. Mm-hmm. This is all about knowing, and it makes sense to me. We have to understand that things come from somewhere, that there are reasons why things are this way. And if we don't understand how the system really creates itself, we won't be able to finance. On the other hand, you're really very powerful stating right now, yes, this is true. But at the center of this, meaning at the center of how to respond to this, has to be not knowing. How do these two spheres go together? What do you mean?
Definitely. This is the sort of core, I think, of both the spiritual practice and the political practice. What we are trying to do is become practitioners of non-dualistic, non-binary thinking. Mm-hmm. And that requires living into the contradiction. Because if we are fearful of contradiction and inconsistency, then the machinery of late stage capitalism wins, because what it's good at is consistency. You know, it's good at telling you there's only one value, one motivator, which is self-interest. And as soon as you go against that, you're in this contradiction. So even me, you know, my clothes are probably made in sweatshop in China, no matter how consciously I curate them or make them or whatever. And so then it tells me I'm a hypocrite. And then I move out of my desire to change that system and go into just, you know, wanting to accept just being a capitalist. And it happens to this is how we get sort of defeated and beaten. So I would say it's critical to be in this non-binary, non-dualistic thinking and practice holding two thoughts at once. So we have to educate ourselves in understanding what's happening So it doesn't mean you're in not knowing in every aspect of your life. History exists, and we know that when we can avail ourselves to that knowledge. You know, not knowing doesn't mean let's ignore the breakthroughs that are happening in science and quantum physics and nanotechnology. And no, clearly we need to understand and sort of expand our toolkit of what is possible, because that allows us to be better creators, better co-creators, better manifestors. But at the same time, we're in the not knowing of what we'll be. Mm-hmm. And that means that we have to rely on prayer, you know, and holding the vision of what we want the post-capitalist realities to be. And those things are not exclusive in any way. Understanding the structure of the system is an area where not knowing does not serve me. Trying to project and predict the future and live in anxiety and fear about what is going to happen does not serve me. Mm-hmm. So in the realm of the future, I am in prayer and I am in not knowing. And in the realm of history and in the now, I will do everything I can within my power, with my privileges, my resources, and my endowments to create the world I want to see.
If I understand you right, you're saying If I want to find strategies how to respond to all of this, if we want to find strategies, we have to create understanding, and we have to appreciate science, we have to appreciate knowing. That is all true, and we have to do this, and we have to educate ourselves. But there's a very different sphere, and this is maybe much primary, much more existential, that all this also our basic non-capacity to hold all of that in a kind of comprehensive view that includes everything. Nobody can do that. And there is the danger that we get overwhelmed, also overwhelmed by the negative news around us. There is an existential position that we have to take to the wholeness of life, to the wholeness of the universe, that appreciates that we don't know. And I hear that also from you, although you didn't say that. You talked about anxiety on the other side, but on the other side of the other side of anxiety is a deep trust in this unknowing, and which I would translate, there is a deep trust in something unconditionally positive in the phenomenon of life, of the universe, that I don't have a rational argument for, but I have a deep relationship with. And this is maybe the foundation of having a spiritual relationship to all of that. It doesn't mean that I don't need to know to inform myself how to create a different world. But underneath, there is something that's beyond it, and that needs my appreciating that there's the mystery, my not knowing, and a deep trust in all of that that really creates the power to create change.
That's beautifully said. Beautifully said. There's a great Ram Dass line where he says, "The universe is perfect, including my desire to change it." Mm-hmm. That this evolutionary process that is happening is not outside of us. It is happening with us and through us. And the more we understand, the more we can be active agents in its creation. But that does require this deep underlying trust. And as you say, there's not a rational argument, you know, because, you know, it is not a problem to be solved. It's a mystery in and of itself. And that is part of the exploration. And we can use that not knowing to feed our anxiety and our depression and to spin out, or we can use it to feed this spiritual practice, which is a direct practice. You know, it is the Gnostic practice of being in communion with the divine, and that requires not knowing. You know, a line that has been said to me a couple of times by a teacher of mine is, trust is the ultimate suicide pact with the universe. Mm-hmm. You know, we are on the edge of consciousness in some way, and we know we are on the brink of either utopia or destruction, but we have to completely surrender to it and know that we will be taken care of, and only in that deep knowing will we jump from the building and have the wings spread. And as soon as we doubt, we are guaranteed suicide. But even in our death, we will know that there is what the Sufis call the deathless death, and there is only rebirth.
Yeah. And if I may add this, and I'm really interested if you would agree to that, it changes fundamentally the nature of the battle, of the fight. Because there is a lot of injustice, there's a lot of inequality, there's a lot of reason also to be angry. But from the point that you're describing right now, the motive to do all of that is not anger, is not hatred. Although I even can understand if people hate the situation they're in and hate that other people do this to them. That's justified in itself. But from the place that you are describing of this deep trust, from this pact with life itself, to even basically jump from the cliff because you trust into something, the motive to do all of that comes from a very different place. And this is also something that I think is extremely important if we ask how to do all of this. How to stand up for justice? How to defend the sacred? I mean, if you look at what happened in Standing Rock, there's a lot of reason to be frustrated, to be angry. But if you see it from a perspective to defend the sacred, you automatically come from a different perspective. And this is also what is changing right now. And I feel this is also what's different to the political struggle like it was in the 60s or 70s, as we understand it. There's a different dimension coming in, and this different dimension is important. It gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah, no, I feel the same way. And yeah, beautifully articulated.
If I may come back to the rules. Reading about the rules, your organization, I find it also very particular that you did not create this for just for the time being. You set yourself a timeline until this organization will exist, and then you will dissolve it. There's something, I forgot the year you were this, there's a certain year you said.
2020.
This is not too far ahead. Why are you doing this, and what are you trying to achieve until 2020?
Well, we come from a more anarchistic political philosophy, which, mm-hmm. which doesn't mean anarchy, you know, as the sort of establishment wants us to think, right? Anarchism is a very sophisticated political philosophy that is just really around localization of power. Mm-hmm. That the sort of people at the community level should be able to decide on how they want to live, which is why I make this corollary with mysticism. You know, it's really the direct intermediation of power. And so part of the anarchistic... or you could even call it localism, you know. But part of this political philosophy is to create organizational structures that are sort of temporary autonomous zones. You know, their sole purpose is not to live forever. You know, and one of the things we said when we started the rules in 2012 is, you know, if we're celebrating our 50th anniversary like these big NGOs do, we would have failed dramatically because the reason to create this and do this work is not for job creation. You know, most NGOs are in the job creation for liberals and their spouses, you know. Mm. And we also don't want to be captured by the world of philanthropy and fundraising and be perpetually in that cycle. We want to create this sort of short period of time, this 8-year window where we would help put radical ideas into the mainstream, so-called radical ideas, you know, and make them feel like common sense, and really challenge and shift the mainstream thinking and mainstream culture on ideas such as development and poverty and climate change and inequality. And so we wanted to create this finite time. And when we started in 2012, one of the things we said is we have no idea what's going to be happening in the world in 2020. And this is not to say our work will stop as activists or as culture hackers. And, you know, it's that we make space for new configurations to emerge, that we ourselves create an organizational structure that allows us to be in the not knowing and to sort of trust that whatever emerges at that point will be commensurate with the problems of its time. And so the work we're focusing on till what we call our supernova date is we've been working on this campaign around universal basic income. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine if the world got, let's say, $30,000 a year. Where would that money come from? How would it work? How do we essentially create a spiritual, creative, intellectual renaissance on this planet so people are freed from the tyranny of bullshit jobs? And they can actually start... working on solving these major problems of our time, which are going to require a deep collective intelligence. And so we've been working with a group called Circles. Some of them are actually based out of Berlin. It's a cryptocurrency that is not based on debt-based fiat currency. So it's based on smart contracts, social contracts. So you could have a universal basic income on the blockchain that is created by the community itself and is dependent on relationships as opposed to, you know, being backed by money that has to grow, or US dollars or euro or what have you. And so it's just one expression of our thinking around the potential of UBI. not in some, you know, libertarian way of let's cut social spending and give people some piddling amount, but an amount that would just shift the way human beings think about work, think about value and how value is created, you know, to really decouple the economic system from growth and GDP. So really a radical economic system that would be based on this idea of universal basic income or universal basic assets, this shared commons-based approach. So that's one aspect of the work. And there's a whole bunch of ideas in this more sort of political economy terrain, including regenerative farming as a solution to climate change, and many other ideas. And then there's another aspect, which is more, I would say, epistemological, which is, yes, there's these very specific alternatives that could help us in this transition, part of this inevitable transition to a post-capitalist world. But there's also a knowledge side. You know, other ways of knowing and being are part of the solution to the post-capitalist world, which is why the re-indigenization of our culture is so important, to go back to the original wisdom of our ancestors, to go back to some of these mystical traditions, to really reinstate animism, this idea that everything is alive and we are part of that interdependent Gaian life force, is sort of central to the political work. So we sort of root our work in both the epistemological and the sort of political economy alternatives.
I wrote down the localization of power. And on one hand, I completely understand what you're saying. I also understand this as a political ideal. But if you just look what's happening right now, and if you just name Facebook, Amazon, whatever, this is the opposite of the localization of power. How can you envision in this rapid growth of digital power, if you may call it this way, Google being maybe the most powerful in that is the very opposite of what you're talking about. How can you envision that this finds a transition to something of this perspective that you were just describing?
Yeah, and this comes back to, and this is a sort of a great point to end on as well, because it comes back to the contradiction. And what somehow what our rational mind wants to do is have some tidy narrative, but actually what's happening is this deep bifurcation. You know, this is the historical moment we're at. Extreme darkness and extreme light. It's the time of the strongman, nationalist, sort of neo-Nazi patriarchs, the Trumps and the Putins and the Netanyahus and the Modis in India. And it's also the time of deep, deep localization. You know, we're seeing this rapid increase in alternative communities and eco-villages, in cooperative ownership structures, in the recommoning of land, in the sort of putting land back into the common stewardship of indigenous peoples. And so both are happening simultaneously. And yes, as the power elites, This is the sort of symptoms of late stage capitalism, right? What modern capitalism is it is the beneficiary of, you know, 12,000 years from the Neolithic revolution to the first city states and all the patriarchy and the violence and the colonialism and the imperialism and the oppression that led to the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution till now. All of it is the same chain. And as it comes to its natural end, you know, as sort of Marx said, and very presciently, that within capitalism contains the grains and the germs of its own destruction. And so it knows that it's on its way out. It knows it cannot have perpetual growth on a finite planet. You know, it knows that you can't have ever increasing, increases in Moore's law and microchip processors and biotech and nanotech and artificial intelligence. All of these things are going to lead to the destruction of life as we know it. And so it is behaving extremely, and wealth is going to concentrate extremely. And we're going to have these gilded gates and these class wars and these wars over resources, as we're seeing now, you know, the first modern city out of water. And then we're going to see simultaneously this increase in what I call the building of the transition infrastructure. And all of these beautiful communities, Tapatitas in Mexico to El Alto, to even all of the social movements from Standing Rock to the pro-democracy movements of Russia and India and Brazil to the umbrella.
In cooperation with One World in Dialogue, we will start at the top of the hour.
Sorry, we lost you for a second. But anyways, that is the point, that we are in the midst of this deep bifurcation and both are happening simultaneously. We have to choose which side we want to be on.
Aldo, thank you very much for this conversation. Thank you very much for this perspective. I just also want to give our audience your website where there's more information of the work that you're doing. It's very simple, the rules, oneworld.org. There's basically the fundamental of what your work is trying to achieve. Thank you for sharing all of that with us. Thank you for having the time, and all the best in Athens right now.
Thank you for having me, Thomas.
Thank you.
Sending love and solidarity.
Love to you.